Yeah. There was a bit of a misunderstanding of cessation. Where is that cessation of consciousness? In this lifetime or that sort of thing? But in general, everybody agreed. Yeah, or the general kind of contention was that it is a good thing to have. So, can you hear now? It was a good thing to have, but whether it is achievable or not was a question. Generally, everybody is trying hard, and the ignorance and sometimes having a good life right now were kind of negatives or things that you may want to live a little or have more kind of lifetimes longer, sort of. Gradual letting go was brought up. That's about it. Generally, yes, everybody wants to have it, or most of them want to have it, but whether it is achievable or not is the question.
What about... Okay. No, that's good.
John Brahmani, did you want to add on to your team's comment?
That's fine. Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
Okay. John Brahmani, see. Okay. Can we have Venerable Sunil Skirt, who's represent?
There was no definite, can you hear? Yeah. There was no definite conclusion arrived. Some viewpoints given were, being good enough for me, six senses controlling factor for consciousness, and like there are varied opinion, whenever Sunyu would say further about it.
Sorry?
You would say further about it, I said, of what we discussed.
What was it again? Sorry, I think he wants you to...
I said, we definitely did not. General opinion was it was good, and there was no definite conclusion arrived.
Yes,
correct?
That's what we did, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. we sort of had sometimes, from certain perspectives, it seems good, and from other perspectives, it seems bad, and from other perspectives, it seems like whatever. So yeah.
So it depends, is it? It's
yeah,
it the group thing.
Depends on how you look at it. That's what I think sort of our conclusion was.
Which perspective is it good from and which perspective is it bad from? That's certain.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that we all came to the conclusion, I don't know if the Venerables will agree with us, that it's at what stage you are in your life and which path you're going on, dependent on whether it was good or bad.
Yep. I think that was discussed in my group as well.
Yeah.
That age has a part to play.
Age. Okay, it's better when you're old, is that right?
Depending on whether you're old or young, that makes a difference. Whether you want it to cease or you
okay,
want it to cease at all.
Mm.
Okay, so thank you. Can we have... Venerable Jung group? Yes, Ananda.
Thank you, Deha, Ajahn, Venerable. We have summarized our voting. This is the results of the voting.
We vote.
So that Trump can't object to it, we have hand tallied. We had 10 saying good, but there are some elaborations, and 1 saying bad. There is a qualification on that too. And 6 saying who knows. And so I might say go to this number 1, who said bad. But the answer that was given was because we have to know. And therefore, if the consciousness ceases, how do we know that we have finished the... that was the point raised by the gentleman who mentioned it. I think there is some way of looking at it and could appreciate that, understand it. And the main thing that came out was that it is always good, that if we see that this is always arising and passing, and therefore that is beyond our control, whether it is good, bad or no, who knows. It's a rising and passing thing, and therefore cessation has to be good, because that is the true saddha, that is what the Buddha said. Aim at that, and saddha, with saddha we look at it. And mention that hard to grasp, this is a sort of theoretical type, which is difficult to grasp. And the fear of the unknown was mentioned, because, again, because of the fear, people don't know, we don't know. And there was a view expressed that it is good to continue with the consciousness so that we can aim at to be reborn in the Brahma world or something, and therefore from there we can finish our work. Katan Karaniya. And then wanting to control, because of the need to control, we think it is good to continue rather than cessation. There was another view. It's good to clean up the consciousness and then at least mitigate the defilements so that we can make sure that we finally end it altogether. That was generally our discussion and the views. Ajahn Venerable, thank you.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Yeah. Actually, I thought this group was quite interesting because we heard a very loud yes from Venerable Gotami. It's like, and then not only just yes, but 100% yes again. So okay. It's like very firm. And I also noticed because we've got like three nuns in a group, and all the nuns are like yes, yes, yes. So maybe that's the trend. Maybe that's the selection process before you can become a monk or a nun. We should ask this question as part of the
okay,
interviewing process.
Yeah.
Good or bad. Okay, so last group, who's representing Venerable Messages group?
We had a pretty good chat. This kind of sums up what we said. I'm just going to read out the points here. Two people said the answer is very bewildering, which I thought was nice. And someone said, if you have confidence that life is suffering, then it's a good thing that it ceases, if there's the confidence there. Two other people said, for the end of the karmic cycle. I'm sure that made more sense in the context of what they said. It's good, it's a good thing, but it's a very hard journey. That was said a couple of times. It's achievable, but it's a hard path to walk. Someone said they can intellectually understand that it's good, but can't say for certain without more experience or understanding of consciousness itself. Who knows, was said. And before you can say either way, we really need to know what consciousness is, similar to the other one as well. Someone said it's bad. It's bad to end it because there's still a lot of illusions about ways and strategies to end suffering in this life, if that makes sense. And the last one I wrote down is, can you trust this process enough to slow down and notice consciousness arising and passing? Which was part of a big answer. That was just the bit that I wrote down.
All right, so back to the teachers.
Want to summarize?
Excellent. I can't summarize because I think everybody has their own ideas and views, and we're all, this was sort of the main point maybe also that was brought up in our group, is we're all at a certain place in our practice, and there were also many people in our group for who this question was irrelevant. They felt it was where they are now in their practice. They don't ask themselves this question really, because it's not the thing that challenges them at this moment, or not the thing that they find important at that moment. At this moment, and so they're practicing more to become more peaceful, more kind, more calm, and whether that leads to a cessation of consciousness or not, you know, they said, I don't really bother about that. And I think that is a nice perspective to come from, because that does apply, I think, in some sense to all of us. We're all where we are, and who knows where we're going to go. Well, maybe some of you do know where you're going. You know that you're going to the cessation of consciousness. I don't know. But, yeah. To summarize, we're all where we are. And also, I had this idea, Wu knows, you know. Wu, there is no Wu. Wu knows.
Wu knows.
Yeah. This was just my idea, not from my group, but I thought if you would ask an arahant, somebody who is enlightened, and you would somehow tell them, oh, you thought your consciousness was going to cease at the end of your life, but you know what? It's not, you're going to be stuck in samsara forever. I think an arahant, because they have no sense of self, they would just be like, okay, whatever, I'll take it. It's just suffering. They don't take suffering personal. So, and they also won't take cessation of consciousness personal. That's just suffering ending. Suffering existing, suffering ending. Doesn't really matter if there's no sense of self there. At some points I thought of.
Yeah.
You have anything, Ajahn?
Absolutely. So one of the practical ways of approaching this whole idea of cessation of things kind of coming to an end is to see what happens in your meditation practice. And one of the things you find out very quickly in your meditation, even if you just calm down a little bit, what does calming down mean? It means things are ceasing. Yeah, that's what it means. It means you have less thought. It means that there's less feeling in the body. And the deeper your meditation is, the more cessation you have experienced already. And when you look at that process of meditation, you realize how delightful it is. Yeah, it is very, very attractive. It is very hard to come out of a nice meditation and not to have some, you know, to be attracted towards that. So just based on that very simple thing that everyone here probably has done to some extent, you can then extrapolate. What happens if I go deeper? Yeah, and you start to understand the deeper you go, the more things cease, the more pleasurable, the more happy, the less suffering there's going to be. Yeah, and then you start to get an idea that cessation is a very positive thing. Of course, there is like a final barrier when you come to consciousness itself, which is like the final thing that you have to let go of. But at least it gives an idea, yeah? And it gives us some sense that you carry on down that track. This is the first point, just to be very practical and pragmatic about it. The second thing to remember is that the reason why it is so difficult to understand, you can tell that many people are really baffled by this question. Yeah, what does it actually mean? Even the idea, what do we mean by consciousness in this context? Yeah, this is already a problem. And what we mean by consciousness is all awareness. Yeah, the ability to experience is really what it means. So it is a very profound thing here. And the reason why it is so hard to understand, if you come back to the Buddhist doctrine and Buddhist theory, is because of the sense of self. The sense of self says, no, this is me. This is like the final frontier of what it means to be you, is consciousness. So it's very hard because you take it to be you. So first of all, the only way you can really understand why cessation of consciousness might be attractive is to break through the barrier of the self-illusion. Once you let go of that, there's nothing really to hinder you anymore. And then cessation actually makes perfectly good sense. Why? Because all that is there is dukkha. Yeah, and if you can get rid of dukkha, yay, dukkha gone. Happy. Yeah, so that kind of makes sense. Anyway. Okay, anyone want to say anything more about this topic? It's very profound. This is kind of, you know, a really, really profound part of Buddhist teachings. Does anyone want to never be a Buddhist again after this? You had enough of Buddhism. Just enjoy the path, enjoy the little things, and then to see what happens. Yeah, it's a really exciting journey, this Buddhist journey. Really exciting. So much bliss and happiness to be had, so much satisfaction, so much peace, so many positive things. And don't try to intellectualize these things too much. Just kind of try to have some sense of what it means. Okay. Yeah? Okay. Yes, that's a good answer to okay. So let's carry on.
So we have been
looking in quite a bit of detail at the idea of consciousness, yeah? And the idea of consciousness is very simple. It basically just means the ability to be aware, the ability to experience anything at all. It's the most basic aspect, pretty much, of what it means to be a being, that you have awareness. If you haven't got awareness, then there is nothing here. So this is kind of a minimal requirement to existence itself. And so what we want to do now, that's what consciousness means in this context. It's important not to kind of mix it up with other ideas of consciousness. This consciousness is a very broad concept. We need to narrow it down just to that. Then we can understand what is going on. And this consciousness, the next factor, independent origination after consciousness, is called nama rupa, which we have translated mental aspects and form. And what I want to look at now is the connection between these two. Because this is, as I said before, one of the most profound connections in all of dependent origination. It's really important to get some, it's very useful to get some idea about what this is about, because then you really understand the core of this whole teaching here. So just briefly, I'll just to summarize briefly the things we looked at before. So consciousness gives rise, that consciousness leads to name and form, is a condition for name and form. In what sense does that happen? So let's just review this very briefly. So we talked before about the stations of consciousness, about how the mind inclines towards a particular state, yeah, whether it is a jhana state or worldly state or whatever it is. And wherever your mind inclines, wherever it has inclined throughout a whole life, when you die, you pass away, that's where your mind goes, because the inclination is already established. Yeah, wherever you incline, then that mind continues in that direction. It's like it pushes itself forward via craving, via the will, via these inclinations. Inclination here, you could say, it is also craving, yeah? Craving to exist in a certain way. These things are all connected to each other. Yeah? So once you have that, I mentioned before about how you can experience your station of consciousness. Yeah? The idea that you can see in your meditation practice when you become peaceful where your mind is leaning. Yeah? What is it that you tend towards? What are the things that obsess your mind or you think about? That is the inclination of your mind. Yeah? It's quite, and it varies a little bit from day to day, but you get a rough idea what your inclination of your mind is, what your station of consciousness is. This is something you can actually experience. And that's very interesting, isn't it? Because what that means, it gives you the data to know roughly where on the path you are. How far have you gone? How much have you given up the sensory world? How interested are you really in meditation? Yeah, it's very easy to say, oh yeah, meditation, yeah, really good. I'm really interested in meditation. But the way to really know how interested you are is actually to see where your mind is leaning to, and not just a theoretical idea. Yeah, I'm interested in meditation. But where does your mind want to go? Yeah, not just what you think you are interested in, but what you really deep down emotionally are interested in. Often these are different things. Theory is one thing, practice is something else. One of the answers to this question I liked about cessation of consciousness, good, bad, who knows? It's good in theory often, but in practice, who knows? Yeah, and this is kind of often how it is, because it's very hard to really get your head around these things. This is a very practical way of having some idea where you are at. And that gives you then a clue also for what you have to do. If you see that you are too attached to certain things, then you know you have to deal with those attachments and cravings. And it gives you some feedback on what is required in your meditation practice. And then once you have that station of consciousness, and the consciousness is leaning in a certain direction, inclining in a certain direction, attached to certain things, then that is where the consciousness continues. Once you die, yeah, and then it continues there, and that that station of consciousness then fixes the other aspects of your personality. Yeah, so consciousness kind of gets a certain level. You get reborn there, and then the other aspects of your personality get fixed by that. And what I mean by the other aspects of the personality, I mean all the other things. When we talk about the five khandhas, the five aspects of personality, consciousness is only one. The four others, sensation, perception, willed actions, and the body, the four other khandhas. those other four khandhas will then be fixed in a certain way. So if you get reborn in a human world, you get a human body. Yeah, you can't get the animal body. Actually, can you? Maybe if you... Yeah, usually not. Yeah, usually get a human body, get reborn in the human world. Maybe you become a cyborg a little bit. You get kind of this transplants and all kind of stuff, but anyway, let's leave that aside for now. Let's just assume that you have a human body and a human world there. And then you have all these other things which are typically human perceptions. Yeah, as a human being, you tend to perceive the world in a certain way. We see the world around us. We see the houses, we see the trees, we see beautiful sides, good sides. And there's a certain range that is experienceable as a human being. Yeah, certain kind of maximum range of perception, a certain minimum range in perception. Yeah, feelings also, the bliss or happiness we feel tends to be within certain ranges. Unless you become a meditator, then you are expanding the range. But when you're doing meditation, it's almost like you're stepping out of the human realm for a short while, into another realm temporarily. But generally as a human being, you have a range of experiences. Your will tends to the objects of the human world. If you get reborn as a human, as an animal, there's another range of experiences you can have. You have a kangaroo body, yeah? Kangaroos. And if you have a kangaroo body, your perception of the world is very different. In our monastery, one of the things about the kangaroos being around you all the time, you realize kangaroos are actually quite different. Well, in some ways, they're similar to human beings, but in other ways, they're very different. Yeah, for example, they are very fearful, all the time very fearful. So you go too close to them, and they jump away. Even though you want to give them a chocolate cake, they still jump away. But if they get to taste the chocolate cake, it's like their eyes light up. Yeah, whoa, chocolate cake. And they're so happy when they eat chocolate cake. Yeah. So in some ways, they are similar. But on the other hand, they have no trust. Yeah, they have been hunted so much and been given so much hardship over maybe many lifetimes. There's no trust left. And because of that, there's always fear. So animal realm is a different range of perception that you have in the human realm. It's more brute. It's more harsh. Kangaroos may seem like very cuddly animals from afar. Get up close, not very cuddly. Yeah, really angry, aggressive, greedy, you know. And when your young one, your child has reached a certain age, your mother kicks you out. Yeah, okay, go away. And, you know, she has a new young one. And if the other one comes too close, she will kind of, you know, shoo it away because it doesn't want to, you know, it's pretty harsh. Yeah, it's a very harsh world compared to the human realm there. Or if you get reborn in the Devaloka, then your range of the five khandhas will be different again. You'll have maybe a beautiful body made of light. Yeah, whoa, that's pretty cool. And you will experience more bliss and more happiness. You perceive the Deva world, which looks quite different from this world. As it says in the suttas, you delight in the Nandana Grove. Yeah, the Nandana Grove is one of those groves that the Devas kind of play around in and mess around in, we find in the suttas. I don't know how literal it is to be taken, but it's there. So again, your range of perception is different, and it's fixed for that lifetime. Why? Because your consciousness has been stationed in that particular realm. So in this way, you can only experience certain things, scope of things. This is what it means to be reborn in a certain realm. And this is the basic meaning of nama rupa, name and form, in dependent origination. It's a fixing of this. So you can see here that, we're all talking about the five khandhas all the way through, but in different ways. Here it is the fixing of the five khandhas in a certain realm, and later on is the process of perception, which is another way of thinking about the five khandhas. Five khandhas, again, are the five aspects of personality, sometimes called the five aggregates. I apologize if I use Pali words without thinking, because that's what we do in the monastery. We just use, everyone understands these Pali words. That's why it kind of becomes natural after a while. Kind of this in language. Yeah, you feel like an outsider straight away. So please correct me if I do that too much. So this is how basically it works. So this is what is meant by nama rupa. What I want to do now is look in more detail about this idea of nama rupa, name and form. Yeah? So consciousness leads to name and form. What does it actually mean? Name and form. It's very strange. It's a strange word, isn't it? Why does the Buddha use the word name and form? It's very weird. I must admit it took me ages to figure this out, at least to some extent. I don't know if I still have figured it out completely, but at least have some idea why the Buddha used this. So first of all, we need to look at the definition in the suttas. How does the Buddha define this? Okay, so what is name and form? Yeah, nama rupa. What did you call it again? Aspects, mental aspects and
yeah,
form?
Yeah, that's
something like that.
Yeah. Mental aspects.
Yeah. So the first one, so as I just mentioned already, first one is the idea of sensation, of Vedana. Yeah, this is one of the five personalities, one of the five khandhas. Yeah, fairly straightforward. We'll come back to this later on. The second one is perception. Perception is how we, our ability to understand the world, to divide the world up, and to be able to see, you know, person, carpet. If you didn't have perception, you couldn't distinguish the person from the carpet. It was just one blur, yeah? And it wouldn't make any sense. It's a good thing we can make that distinction. Someone asked about, well, how come perception is not independent origination? Yeah, because you see the link of consciousness, you see the link of willed activities, you see the link of feelings, of sensations, and you also see the link of rupa, you see that in nama rupa, but sanya is missing. So how come all the five, four of the five personality factors are there, but one is missing? Well, here it is, yeah? It's not actually missing, it's right there, it's just that you have to know the right place to look. It's part of nama rupa. So all the five aggregates are there, otherwise it would be impossible. So this is where it arises then. Okay, so then we have, actually, let me look over here, it's better. Then we have intention. Yeah, this is one other one that's mentioned here, and this is chetana. And so that is, as I mentioned before, very similar to the idea of sankhara. Sankhara and chetana are really just different words for the same thing. Yeah, both mean intention in this context, willed activities or intention. So this is the sankhara khanda. Yeah, the aspect of sankhara in the five khandhas, personality factors. Then we have contact is mentioned in here. And contact, we will see later on, is just our ability to experience the world. Yeah, you experience the world through contact, one of the six senses. The reason, I'll just go one more. Then we have attention. And attention is how we use our mind to attend to different things. Yeah, you see projector screen, so you kind of move your attention around. You attend to things in a certain way. So that is a sub-aspect of intention. Yeah, when you attend to something, you have an intention to attend to that thing. Yeah? So those last three factors there, intention, passa, and manasikara, intention, contact, and attention, they are all aspects of sankhara. Yeah, these are all aspects of the fourth of the five aggregates, sankhara, fourth, yeah. Yeah, because they all have to do with how we use the mind, how we direct the mind, and these kind of things. Passa is a little bit funny, I'm not sure exactly how it fits in, but I'm not sure, maybe some Abhidhamma influence perhaps, because in the Abhidhamma they branch out and include all these various factors within sankhara, all the factors that don't fit anywhere else. Bang, you put it into sankhara. That's how the Abhidhamma works. Yeah, so let's have a look at the last one. Form, rupa. Yeah, so this is the materiality or the bodily form. So you can see, yeah, four khandhas are there. Yeah, all the four khandhas apart from consciousness. Yeah, this is what is meant by name and form. So some interesting questions here arise. Why does the Buddha call it name and form? Why doesn't he call it four khandhas? Why doesn't he say the four personality factors? Why does he make it so difficult? Yeah, hard enough to understand the Dhamma already. We don't need these extra complications. Surely, if the Buddha says this, must be a reason. Yeah, otherwise he wouldn't be saying these things. There must be a reason why he does this. So this is really, you can take this to be a later elaboration. The Buddha started out with name and form, and certain monastics or lay people would have asked, but Master, what do you mean by name and form? I don't understand anything. What is going on? Yeah, and this is a bit like reading the sutras. Boha, what does this mean? And then they say, okay, it means this. Yeah, in this context, you can take it to mean this. But still, there must be a reason why the Buddha talks about it in this way. Yeah. Before I say anything about that, one of the other things which is very interesting here is that consciousness is the one factor that is taken out. Yeah, the other four khandhas, the other four personality factors, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Rupa, they are on one side. And on the other side is consciousness. So why is consciousness taken out in this way? Why is consciousness separated out? Why isn't Sanya separated out instead? Why isn't Sankara separated out? What is it about consciousness that is so special? Yeah, do you see what I mean? It puts consciousness on one side. Why is consciousness treated in this particular way? And the answer is that consciousness, as I mentioned before, is the most basic aspect of existence. If you want to investigate what you take to be yourself, if you want to investigate inwards and try to uncover the sense of self that we have that the Buddha says is false, then you peel back, it's like an onion, and you peel back layer by layer, peeling back. And as you peel back, you end up with consciousness. It is the most basic aspect of what it means to exist. And again, if you think about your own meditation experience, you will have some idea that this is true already. Yeah? Gradually, as you become more peaceful, your body starts to fade away. Yeah, you know that that is true. As you become more peaceful, it's as if your will becomes less active. Yeah? Peace means less willing, because willing is the movement of the mind. The will is dying down until eventually it dies down completely. Your perceptions and feelings are gradually becoming reduced, more and more refined. Yeah, but there's one thing that seems to be there all the time, behind all of these other things. And that is the vijnana, the consciousness. It is the one thing that kind of seems to be always there, in a sense. And that is why, like Venerable Sunyo said before, in the Brahmanical teachings, the Atman, the self, is often taken to be consciousness. It's identified with consciousness. That is what the self is taken to be, precisely because we know through our own experience that this is the most basic thing that we can hold on to. So this is why consciousness is taken out. Yeah, and if we can show, and this is what this is going to show now, if we can show that that consciousness does not exist on its own, but is dependent on something else, yeah, and we will show in a second it depends on nama rupa. If we can show that, then we know that consciousness itself has no independent and inherent existence. Yeah, it does not exist on its own. It exists only dependent on causes and effects. Take away, not causes and effects, on conditions and results. And we had an agreement before we started this work. We're not going to use the word cause. So causes and effect, conditions and effects. Sorry? I'm conditioned, but I need to recondition a bit, I think. Okay. So, if we can show that consciousness depends on conditions, not causes, be quite clear about that, depends on conditions or dependent on whatever, then we can also show it has no independent, inherent existence. You cease the conditions, consciousness itself must cease as a consequence. And this is what dependent origination is about. Here you look at the cessation mode, sankhara nirodha, vijnana nirodho. From the cessation of willed actions, consciousness itself ceases. So this is why consciousness is singled out in this way. But why this strange word, name and form? So to understand that...
I remember now, earlier you asked me what was your translation for nama, and the literal meaning of nama is name, which doesn't really mean much in English in this context, and I had personal aspects instead of mental aspects. We have been translating it through in the slides as mental aspects, which is more aligned with common translations by, for example, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who uses mentality or something like that. But if you look at what name actually is defined as, these five factors which are here in gray, they include things like sensations and perceptions and
if you know a bit more in detail how those are defined, then you know that there is six types of sensations and six types of perceptions. And those include the mind, the mental stuff, but also they include all the other five senses. Those are also included in nama. And this is, it makes it more difficult to translate also.
Yeah. Personal factors is nice then, because this is what makes a person. Yeah, you have different perceptions. I think it's actually quite a nice translation. Mm. Maybe until we see the drawbacks in a few minutes.
We must at some point seen the drawbacks because we changed it from that to mental.
It's very hard to translate, basically.
But hopefully we can go beyond translations a bit in these classes. That's sort of one of our goals of Ajahn Brahmali and me, is to get you beyond that. Anyway.
Okay. So why does the Buddha use name and form? I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this then, just to understand what is going on here. And as always, there is a Vedic connection. So Vedic is the Brahmanical text, the ancient precursor to Hinduism from India that existed before Hinduism. And this is where this term was used. Yeah, this is why it is so interesting. It was used in the ancient Brahmanical teachings. So we can assume that the reason why the Buddha used this was to give this idea a new meaning, a new Buddhist meaning, so as to counter the ancient Brahmanical teachings. Yeah. So this is like saying, okay, this is what they say about Nama, but actually this is what it really means if you see it with full insight. Yeah. So the Buddha was kind of countering that. A lot of his teaching is about countering existing misconceptions in the culture, which you have to do if you're going to establish a new teaching. Really, you have to sort of, plot out what this is. This is the way I see things, and it's different from what already exists. Otherwise, you don't really have a teaching. So it's natural that the Buddha should do these things. It's not because he wants to argue with everyone. Yeah, that's not what we expect of the Buddha, wanting to argue with everyone. But in fact, he specifically says he doesn't argue. So Vedic connection. So in the Vedas, so in the Upanishads, I think the Upanishads are like not the earliest Vedas, but a later layer of the Vedic texts, quite close in time to Buddhist teachings. Yeah, people say that the Upanishads, there's a large number of them, but the earliest Upanishads were written one to three centuries before the Buddha. This is the closest you get of the Brahmanical teachings to Buddhism, and that's why it is particularly interesting here. And they talk about the self. Yeah, the Atman is very, very important in these Upanishadic teachings. And one of the core ideas of the self is that it is consciousness. Yeah, so the self is the ability to be aware, the ability to kind of be conscious or whatever. In other words, to have experiences. This is how it is defined, and one of the most basic ways in the Upanishads. So you can imagine, straight away, if that is what the Brahmins say, then the Buddha, if he sees that consciousness actually is impermanent, consciousness ultimately is suffering, then he has to show that it is not a perfect Atman. In fact, he has to show that consciousness itself is conditioned by other things. If he can show that, then he has overturned the Brahmanical teaching, looking at things from a completely different point of view. Yeah. So consciousness itself is a very common expression in these teachings. And then, once this conscious self exists, it creates or gives name and form to the world around it. Yeah. So this is how the consciousness expands its own sense of self. Yeah. By naming the world around it, by creating and naming the world. It's almost like the same thing. And naming and creating is almost considered equivalent. Why? Because if something doesn't have a name, does it exist? Usually when we think about things, we sort of think about things that, have a name. If something doesn't have a name, then it's almost as if it doesn't exist. But if you look at the ceiling, you can sort of see ceiling. But if you take an arbitrary white point in the middle of the ceiling, there's no name for that apart from arbitrary white point. An arbitrary white point doesn't really, it doesn't have an existence, yeah? So by naming things, that's how we become aware of them. That is how, in a sense, we create them. That's how they come into existence. And this is kind of the idea that you see here in the Brahmanical text, yeah? You name the world. By naming things, you are actually creating them. You're giving them a kind of existence. Now you can start to see what is going on here. And one of the things about this naming process, it has many things in common with the five khandhas. This is what is interesting about this. So when you want to name something, perception is a very important part of that. Because perceiving something means to single it out as a specific entity. It means to understand it as something. And then once you single it out, then you give it a name. Then it exists. So perception and naming are very, very closely related to each other. We perceive things that we name, and we name things that we perceive. And so these are very, very closely related. And also, naming also includes the willed activity. We are acting to create these names. So it is an action that we are doing. And very often it is also connected with feeling, because, we feel good or bad about these things that we name. We give them good and bad names and all of that kind of stuff. So it is quite closely related to the three mental khandhas, feeling, perception, and sankhara. And this is what is missing here. Now you can start at least a little bit to see the connection between these things. So in the Vedic tradition, you start off with consciousness, and then the consciousness acts in the world, expands that sense of self. The consciousness is the self, right? That sense of self gets expanded by naming the world around it, and then it infuses that with itself. It inhabits that name and form that it has created. The consciousness goes into it. So you can see it's very similar to what you're talking about in the Buddhism. Buddhist teaching is that you have, on the one hand, you have the consciousness, and then you have consciousness almost like inhabiting the other mental khandhas. Not quite inhabiting, it is because here it is more like one whole kind of soup of things coming together. But it's a similar kind of idea that we have. Again, if we can show that, that the things here are not really, they don't really deserve to be called the self because they're all conditioned, and we have undermined this whole idea of this building of an Atman in according to the Vedic teachings. The Atman identifies with the name and form. I am the name and form, just like we. We also identify with the name and form. If I say I'm going to cut off your hand, what are you going to say? You're going to say yes or no, thank you. No, thank you. You don't really want that. It's handy to have a hand. It is handy to have a hand. Why? Because you have an attachment to your body. It's also because it's handy. There's no point in giving up the hand. But the main reason is because this is my hand. Don't you dare take my hand. You're going to cut it off? No way you're going to cut it off. And in the same way, we identify with all the five khandhas, the body, the perceptions that we have, the feelings we have, the will, everything. We identify with all that. So again, it is similar to what we see here with Nama Rupa in the Vedic tradition. So in a sense, the Vedic tradition, the way they use Nama Rupa is very similar to how we use the four khandhas without consciousness in the Buddhist tradition. And this is why, this is the main reason why the Buddha uses this. So now he can give a critique through his way of explaining dependent origination. It is an implied critique of the Vedic tradition here. Does anyone have the faintest idea what I'm talking about? Is it making sense? Nama Rupa, four khandhas, Because vijnana, because consciousness is outside, Because the consciousness, so there are only the four other ones remaining here. Thank you, Carl. So let us let's stop there for just a minute, Bronwyn, and then come back to the question after. Is that okay? Let's just have a 5 minutes break, because otherwise the bing explodes. So we just okay.
carry on. Okay. Ron, did you want to ask a question? Or here? Would you mind using the microphone with your right hand? Yeah.
Sorry, I was just wondering if when you're talking about the four khandhas, if you're talking about the four noble truths.
No, the four aspects of personality. Yeah?
All right.
The feelings, the perceptions, the willed activities, and the body.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else like to say anything? Yeah. No? Okay. Marvelous. Do you consent by silence? That's what they do in the Sutta. They consent by silence. Yeah. If you ask questions, they say silence. Okay. No, that's good. Oh, then, yeah. Over here.
Ajahn, is there a reason that we translate vijnana as consciousness and not as awareness? Is it like a bigger scope or a smaller scope? I've been trying to consider this myself.
Yeah, this is just one of those things. I think the reason is it probably comes back to people like, people who were philosophers, and they kind of used consciousness in a way that was used in philosophy in the West or something like that. And the word consciousness in its bare meaning has that kind of very meaning. It's very similar to awareness. I think that's maybe the reason. But I think in many ways awareness might be more suitable, to be honest with you, for vijnana than consciousness, because consciousness has so many meanings these days.
It seemed like a big airy-fairy thing in our discussion group, and I'm like, well, awareness isn't airy-fairy. Like you're aware.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you, actually, so I'm wondering. So maybe we should make a new translation. You want to do it, Venerable? Yeah. One of these days we can get started. Okay. Gabriel, please.
So on this point of awareness, so the consciousness we find close to the empty core of the onion, as you say, then it's more as a very, very raw sort of awareness. It's not necessarily a man of vijnana in the sense it's observing or dealing with that mental phenomena. It's just awareness itself. That's the question.
I don't really get it. Yeah.
So close to the corn, to the empty core of the onion, as you said, you find vijnana.
Yeah.
And the question I have is that vijnana you find is just the awareness, the raw awareness, or it's just the cognization or cognizing of a mental event?
It's the same thing here.
Okay.
Cool. At least that's the way I would look at it. Yeah. I mean, it's all about terminology, and people use terminology in different ways.
So but cognizing awareness and consciousness would all be the same in your understanding in this topic?
It means experience. Yeah, ultimately that's what it means. The ability to experience anything here. That's what it is there.
Okay.
Whereas consciousness often means things like, being conscious about people's plight in Africa or some disaster somewhere. It's more like having a particular kind of awareness. This is just the ability to experience what it means. Yeah. So any kind of experience you have, the root of that will always be consciousness. That's what does the experiencing, if you like. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one more thing, let's say, I really appreciate unpacking a bit how the five khandhas are spread in these first links, because it was a very, very huge blind spot up to now, so I'm really grateful for that.
Okay, marvelous.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Yeah. So one thing I should say to what Gabriel was just talking about there is that when I say that at the core of this whole onion is awareness or experience or consciousness, it doesn't mean that it can exist apart from the other aggregates. So you have to have at the minimum some kind of feeling, some kind of perception there at the minimum, together with consciousness. But the feelings and perceptions, they change all the time. They're always moving, whereas consciousness is the one thing that seems to be stable. And that's why I call it the core of the onion. Not that it can actually exist by itself. And this is kind of the whole point of this, that it cannot exist by itself.
I was just wondering, Ajahn, if the beings of existing in other realms, do they have body and nama rupa?
They do. It depends a bit on what kind of realm you're talking about, but they will have fine material realm. What bodies? Not like these coarse bodies that we have. Yeah, these really solid bodies. More like fine, delightful, bright, beautiful bodies. That's the Devaloka. And that's why they can last for 20,000 years. Yeah? This body, hopefully, will not last for 20,000 years, because it will be very problematic after after a while. So it is body, but it's a kind of materiality of the physical world, according to Buddhism, comes in a very in different degrees. Yeah? So it's coarse and more and more refined. It's more and more refined as you move up these various realms.
So the 12 links do apply to them, all of them as well.
Sorry?
The 12 links of...
It applies to everyone, yeah. It applies even when you go to the... If you go to the immaterial realms where there's no body at all, there comes a point when all physical aspects are completely gone. The pen origination still applies. It applies even to the mind by itself. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Everyone. You can't escape that way.
Unfortunately. Thank you.
But it seems that some of the definitions are very specific to more like the human experience. For example, human has six senses.
Yeah.
But some animals have like other senses that we don't have. And some of the very high realms, they may only have the mind sense.
Mm. That is true. So not all of them. Everything applies to all the realms. So, like this, you know. But at the minimum, you have to have one sense to kind of function. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Because I think that's what you were pointing at with the question. The underlying principle is still applies to everyone who is not enlightened, whether human or animal or some god or whatever. But yeah, the details, of course, they differ from one realm to the other.
This has been what people have been trying for forever. Yeah, this idea of getting reborn in heaven and staying there forever after. But that's kind of one of those important insights of the Buddha that doesn't work. That cannot work regardless. Yeah. Okay, so let's take a couple of questions from outside. Okay, Long Ru Fang, asked the question before. So hello there. Nice to have you here. I'm not sure if we have met before, but anyway. Is there a process of cessation of self? How does cessation of self happen? Is it being less self-centered? Okay, these are really good questions, and I shall be very happy to discuss them at least a little bit. Is there a process of cessation of self? Well, remember, there is no self. So because there is no self, the self cannot cease. Yeah? What ceases is the notion, the feeling that there is a self. It's a falsehood, it's a delusion that ceases. And then when you see a reality, you see there was no self in the first place. So it is this idea of a self, the view of a self, the feeling that there is a self, that is what comes to an end. And what is so beautiful about it is that it actually is an illusion. So it stops you from living life well, it stops you from making the right decisions. When we are deluded, by definition, we make bad decisions. And those bad decisions are precisely sankhara, and they keep the whole thing going here. How does cessation of self happen? Well, the cessation of the self-delusion happens through insight, yeah? And it happens gradually. So you start off by meditating, and as you become more and more peaceful, you can see that all of these things, they fall away. Yeah, things fall away, you become more and more peaceful, you think less, your body is gradually disappearing, your perceptions are calming down, your feelings are becoming less. And so all of those things, because they fall away, they must be non-self. And ultimately, because a self is something that, by definition, is always there. If something can come to an end, it cannot be a self. And ultimately, you keep on going like that until you see everything. The whole caboodle is empty of any inherent essence. And that is when you understand the idea the idea of a self actually is a falsehood. So, yeah. Is it being less self-centered? Yes, it's a very good start. Yeah, we had that question here before. If you are less self-centered, you're already reducing the sense of self. People have a very strong sense of self in the world. It's much more difficult for them to meditate or do anything because it's more difficult to let go. Yeah, it is about controlling things, about holding on to those things that you take to be yourself. So being less self-centered is a wonderful start point with that. Being more generous, being more caring, thinking so much about yourself, but thinking about other people, and it leads to a lot of happiness if you do that. Okay, and this is from Mario, AWK Mario fan. Not sure what that means, but anyway, hello Mario. What is enlightenment? Enlightenment is the highest happiness. Ending of all suffering? Yay, happy. It's good. Think of it like that, because it can be very hard to understand from any other
point of view, but think of it as the highest happiness, yeah, and start to see how it occurs in your meditation practice gradually, gradually. From Indira Fernando, hello Indira. The Buddha mentioned that kamma is only one aspect and mentioned about the other niyamas. Can you kindly explain? Niyamas, this is something you find in the commentaries. Niyamas means like the laws of existence. They're not really used in this way in the suttas. So kamma niyama is the law of kamma, yeah? And then there are other lamas, the uttu niyama. Uttu means like seasons, yeah? It's like the weather coming. And so the commentaries make the system whereby they talk about different laws. I wouldn't worry too much about those other niyamas that don't occur in the suttas, and I tend just to talk about what is in the suttas myself. So I don't really know all that much about these niyamas because I'm not interested, to be honest. So I'm probably the wrong person to ask. So anyway.
And I have never heard of it before, so yeah. I would also not be the right person.
There you are, yeah. Okay, so this is from Gabriel Atamaloka. Okay, I know what that is. Could this consciousness we find close to the empty core of the onion also be called awareness? Okay, there you are. So, so that's already answered. The last one is from Mike in the USA. How does one contemplate cause and effect in one's meditation? The way to contemplate it is, there's many ways of doing that, but one of them is to understand the process of meditation itself. Yeah, so it's important to contemplate something that is useful. So if you're trying to deepen your meditation practice, it's very useful to know the causes or the conditions that lead to deeper meditation practice. So look at your mind. Where is your mind inclining when your meditation works? It may be inclining towards peace, inclining towards letting go and all these kind of things, yeah? And you start to notice what are the mind states, what are the conditions that then lead to more peace, yeah? What is the right time to meditate? What is the best time for me? What should I contemplate beforehand to kind of get the mind in the right situation? So I always recommend people to, after your meditation, take a few minutes to contemplate your meditation. Ask yourself, what worked, what didn't work? And as you do that, you start to be able to understand the whole process, the conditionality, the causes that lead, the conditions that lead to good results in your meditation practice. That's one very useful way of looking at conditions and results. Another very important way of reflecting on it is to think about how you feel about yourself when you act in certain ways. Yeah, you act with kindness. And how does that feel? You act in a way which is unkind. How does that feel? And the more you understand that, the more ability you will start to become a better person as a consequence, because you start to see it is in your own self-interest to live well and to be kind to other people. Okay. Would you like to add anything, Monsignor?
Yeah, it's a very broad question. How do you contemplate cause and effect in meditation? There's many depths that you could take it, but I like the approach you took. I see what causes you to be more happy and what causes your meditation to be deeper. And just to realize what that was that causes it to go deeper, like paying attention in a certain way to your breath or letting go. And just to realize what it was by asking the question, what made me more peaceful? Just that realization is enough. You don't need to contemplate it very deeply, like how did it work. That's what I find anyway in my meditation. I don't need to really contemplate very deeply from why did I become more peaceful. If I just realize what I did and what the result was, then that is. When I realize that, it sort of ingrains this pattern inside of me to do it again the next time, to let go. For example, I hope that makes some sense. What I'm saying is, when you think of contemplating, it often becomes quite intellectual. But meditation is not intellectual; it's more comes from emotion and feeling. So you contemplate from the level of feeling instead of using your brain too much. That's what I would say.
Okay. Good. Yeah. So that is
think there's no more questions.
Oh, Venerable, okay.
I've been trying to sort of set a tone that I'm a process as opposed to an I. And the language we use, you know, I checked that I was doing this and then I made an adjustment. I think Ajahn Brahm's contribution, Ajahn Ramali's over the years to say, if you can get the I out of the way. But that in itself seems to feel fairly difficult, but yet intuitively we kind of know what that is. So if the feeling was, I'm agitated, or this sense inside there is some agitation, and then it goes to peace. But I think as soon as we add the I back into the conversation, then I can, oh, I did that myself. Tick. You know? But then that can pull you back to craving and stuff.
It can. That's true. So that's why there is no kind of peace until you become a, you know, have some deep insight. That's when you get the real peace. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Jen, is there a difference between Chittanupassana and contemplation of the consciousness that you were just saying now?
There is, yes. Chittanupassana, the main purpose of that is to abandon the refined defilements of the mind. Yeah, this is what the whole Satipatthana is about. It's about the final defilements before you enter samadhi. And if you look, you know, you look at the whole Satipatthana, it's really concerned about defilements and how to let go of them. This contemplation here is much more profound. This is where kind of after you come out of samadhi, and then you understand that the consciousness itself is conditioned and it's not a solid thing. I'm answering short because I would like to kind of move on a little bit, if that's okay. Can we wait for the time? Is that all right? Because I'm just time is just going so fast, and I you know, and as always, I have lots of things to say, but can't say them all. So this is one important reason why it is called Nama Rupa, and why that is found in dependent origination. But there is one more reason, and this other reason has more to do with how the Buddha presents his teachings. So here you have the standard sequence of dependent origination again, focusing on those middle factors there. We have the mental aspects and form, nama rupa. Normally you have the six senses, but in one sutta those are missing and you go straight to sense impressions instead. And that's the pasa, and then based on the sense impressions, then you have the vedana, the feeling or the sensations. This is an important point, because what this means is that you don't, from this point, there's an alternative way of thinking about how we experience the world. One way of thinking about it is through the six senses. Another way of thinking about it is through nama rupa itself. We experience the world through these two factors. And this is why the Buddha used, another reason why the Buddha used nama rupa. So this is the use of nama rupa in relation to contact. You skip the six senses. Go straight from nama rupa, straight to contact. And what is interesting about this, I'm going to do this very briefly, because I'll talk more about this later on, is that there's two kinds of contact. The first one is the impact contact, or impingement contact, where the object kind of hits the eye. That's one way of thinking about it. So the impingement on the eye. So you see something. That's the impact contact. Or you hear something. It hits the ear. Or you smell something. Or you touch something, whatever it is. This is known as the impingement contact. Patiga sampasa is it called in Pali. That is one. So you can see here, all the six senses are included in one kind of contact. So it's a different way of thinking about the idea of contact. But then there is more to contact than that. Contact here means experiencing the world, how we experience the world. There's another aspect called the naming contact, adivachana sampasa. Vachana quite literally means to speak. Adivachana is like designating or naming, very, very closely related to that. And this is the idea that not only do we experience the world through the senses, but once that object has been experienced, then the mind works on it. The mind makes sense of it.
And that is the naming contact, when we kind of make sense of that thing. This is what perception is about. This is what feelings are about. And sankharas and all these kind of things. We work on this object in our own way. Yeah? And this is a very important point. Because if there was only the six senses, you might think that we all experience the world in the same way. Yeah? Because we're all getting the same input. But we know that is not true. We know that every one of us experiences the world slightly differently. And the reason is this one here. The reason is because the naming contact, our minds are all a little bit different. We have our own conditioning, our own background, all of these kind of things, which works on these impacts and then creates the world. And that is good news. What do you think? Is that good news? It's good news, yeah, because what it means is that we don't have to experience the world we are doing now. If we develop the mind in the right way, then our experience of the world will change and it will lead us in the right direction. Otherwise, we might be trapped in the human realm. We always have to experience things in the same way. So this is the other reason why the Buddha uses this thing here. Namarupa. But okay, so now I'm going to come back to what this is really about. It's taken us a while to get there, but now we're getting there. And so this is going to talk about what I call the mutual conditionality between vijnana, consciousness, nama-rupa, name and form, yeah, personal aspects and form, on the other hand. Mutual conditionality means that they support each other. They cannot exist independently, yeah? And this is specifically stated in this particular sutta you can see here. DN 15 is the long discourse of the Buddha, number 15. The Mahanidana Sutta, the greatest sutta on conditionality or causation or sourceability, whatever it is. And it looks like this, yeah? Consciousness, what does that lead to? Mental aspects and form. Yeah, we've seen this all the time. But you may remember now, if you remember back to what we have been doing all along, so far, the condition for consciousness has been sankhara. Yeah? Willed activities have been the condition so far. But in some suttas, it's different. And this sutta is different. So what do you think is the condition for consciousness here? Who said Namarivata? Yeah. Okay, so this is like, I'm testing your knowledge of the suttas here. Namarupa, exactly right. Yeah. So Namarupa itself is the condition here for consciousness. Yeah, this is what it looks like. And if you go, and then there is nothing before Namarupa, there's nothing prior to that. This is the beginning of the chain. Yeah. So what that means is that these things are mutually dependent on each other. If you go back before mental aspects and form, what do you find? Consciousness, exactly. You find consciousness again, yeah? And if you go back before that, more Namarupa. And so it goes on and on, ad infinitum, yeah? You can just go back life after life, and there's no first point of this mutual conditionality between these two things. And this is really the core kind of insight of the Buddha independent origination, because what this means is that consciousness, vijnana, depends on all the other factors of personality for its existence. Yeah? Consciousness does not exist independently. So we saw before that consciousness is taken to be the Atman, the self, the permanent self in the Vedas. So what the Buddha does by this, he's contradicting directly the content of the Vedic text, the Brahmanical text, saying no, there is no such Atman, there is no such Atta, some self that exists independent of phenomena. All aspects in the world are dependent on something else. Consciousness itself depends on name and form, mental aspects and form. Mental aspects and form also do not exist independently because they in turn are dependent on consciousness. Yeah, mutual conditionality. Yeah? They revolve around each other. It looks like there's no escape. Yeah, that's what it looks like when you see that. But of course there is. But that's what it looks like when you see this mutual revolving around each other. And there's a beautiful simile in the suttas that show you this. It's the simile that Venerable Sunyo mentioned before of the two sheaves of reed. These are not really sheaves, but you know, you get the idea. Yeah, so they stand up in dependence on the other one. If you pull one away, the other one will fall. If you pull the other one away, then the one will fall. These are mutually dependent on each other. This is the idea of mutual conditionality. There's nothing in existence, according to the Buddha, that stands on its own, that can be separated out and has an existence independent of all other things. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go to a very well-known sutta called the Kacchana Gotta Sutta. It's found in the Nidana Sanghita, the Connected Discourses on Causation, number 15. It's very famous in the history of Buddhism because it has been used by some of the greatest scholars in Buddhism, both Mahayana and also Theravada is the wrong word, but all the schools of Buddhism has been used to explain what Buddhism really is about. And a very famous Buddhist philosopher who lived 500-600 years after the Buddha, called Nagarjuna, he used this particular discourse to elaborate on the Buddhist teachings. So it's a very, very well-known discourse in Buddhist philosophy, Kacchana Gotta Sutta. And this discourse is really relates directly to this, yeah? The idea that there's nothing inherently existing in the world and how to view that. So let's go to this sutta. There you are, you have the reference to the sutta, Kacchana Gotta Sutta. Kacchana Gotta is this monk who comes to the Buddha and asks him a question. And he asks him the question about right view. Yeah, and this is what the Buddha has to say about right view. Oh yeah, yeah. They speak of this thing called right view. How is right view to be understood? Or how is it defined? It says here. Yeah, so how is right view defined? What does it mean? Kacchana, this world mostly relies on the dual notions of existence and non-existence. We're getting very deep here, so again, I apologize if you feel that you cannot follow 100%, but it's not difficult to understand, but sometimes you just need to get used to these ideas to kind of figure out what's going on. So the world relies on the dual notions of existence and non-existence. What does that mean? What is the world? Well, the world is just humanity, it's just people. Yeah, people rely on these things. What does it mean that we rely on something? And what it means is that basically we are attached to these things. Yeah, these are important things that make up our sense of self, make up a sense of who we take ourselves to be. Yeah, these are everyone has views and opinions. It's impossible to live without views and opinions. You have to have that. And these are some of the most basic views and opinions you can have. So your very sense of self depends, relies on these views and opinions to be able to function properly. That is what it means here. People, the world, relies on these two notions, the two ideas. Yeah, we have ideas about whether we exist or not, these kind of things. What are these two notions? The idea of existence and the idea of non-existence. And these ideas, the idea of existence in Brahmanism and Buddhism means, this is kind of the idea in that culture at that time, existence means that there is something inherent inside of you that is permanent, that is always there. That's existence, yeah? You exist in an absolute way. You're all this core of who you are is always present. Yeah, and if you think about the world, this is exactly how most of the world works. Yeah, you think about most religions, they will say you have a soul, and that soul, when you die, goes to God, and then you hang out with God for, a long time. Some people say eternity, but whatever. And this is a very, very common view in the world. Most of the theistic religions in the world, they have an idea of this kind of existence, and we last, something lasts eternally. Or they say God lasts eternally. And that's the same thing as saying the soul lasts eternally. It's just a different, you just kind of see that permanence in a slightly different way, but it's basically the same thing. And then there is the opposite view, the idea of non-existence. And this is the idea that there is nothing inherent inside of you that lasts forever. Yeah, and this is the idea of annihilationism, Uccedavada in the suttas. And this is the idea that because there's nothing inside of you, which is you don't have a core, when you die, that's it. You are finished. Yeah, and that's the end of everything, and nothing happens after that. That is called annihilationism in Buddhism. So these are the two views of the world. And it's fascinating, yeah? This idea of annihilationism, yeah, which is so common in the world today. A lot of people who call themselves atheists or agnostics even, when they would subscribe to this particular view, this is the right way of thinking about the world. Yeah, and sometimes we think this is a very modern view. Yeah, we are modern. We don't believe anything happens after death. Yeah, that's kind of superstition. We are real modern people. We don't believe in this nonsense about past lives or whatever, or future lives or whatever it is. But these views have existed at least since the time of the Buddha, 2,500 years. Yeah, nothing particularly modern about it. Yeah, rather, if you want to be modern, you should reject that view, come up with something else, because it's always been there. And this is the thing, and the reason why these views exist is not because we are modern or not modern, or we are ancient or whatever. The reason these views exist is because they are a basic reaction to the sense of self. Once you have a sense of self, then these ideas emerge as a consequence. Either you exist or you don't exist. That's a consequence of feeling I am inside of you. And that is why we rely on these things. Yeah, you feel I am, and then you think, wait a minute, but how is it that I am? Am I, you know, is this kind of permanent? Yeah, it feels pretty permanent. Okay, it must be eternalism. Yeah, and then I go to God after I die or whatever. Actually, it doesn't feel all that permanent at all. Maybe it's just kind of, you know, things moving around. Okay, when I die, everything will cease. You can see how that happens. But because we tend to be attached to existence, we tend to be attached to being here, yeah, because that is a very important part of attachment, the majority of people tend to have the notion of existence. And that is why the theistic religions have been very prominent around the world, and even to the present day. They have always been the most prominent because it is naturally where the human mind inclines. In Buddhism, very large part of Buddhism as well, there is ideas of existence. Yeah? Buddhism too is prone to these things because it's a very powerful drive in human beings. We want to exist. Not everyone, but for many people it is. And because of that, Buddhism itself gets contaminated. And there's a large part of Buddhism that talk about eternal mind, yeah, eternal consciousness, which is exactly what the Buddha is contradicting in suttas like this, yeah, or the dependent origination. Consciousness ceases. The mind ceases, as it says elsewhere. Yeah? So things come to an end. But the power of these defilements, of the desire to exist, is so powerful. Sometimes it overpowers what actually exists in these texts. So these are the two things that the world relies on. Yeah. So let's move on. So what happens if you are a Buddhist? How do we look at this differently? That's what comes up next. But when you truly see the origin of the world with right understanding, yeah. When you truly see the origin of the world with the right understanding, what do you think that is? A Big Bang, maybe? Maybe not, yeah. I don't think the Buddha had any ideas about the Big Bang. It must mean something else. So what does the Buddha mean by the origin of the world? And this really hinges on the meaning of the word world. Yeah, what does world mean in Buddhism? And in Buddhism, in a famous sutta called the Rohitasa Sutta, found in the numerical discourses in the fours, number 44, something like that. Anyway, the Buddha talks about what the word world means in according to the Dhamma. And he says the world, he says, is found in this body with this consciousness. So when we talk about the world, what we mean our personal world. Yeah, right now, I experience the world in a certain way. This is my world. Yeah, I see all of you. I see the Dhammaloka Center. I see the sun shining beautifully outside. Jacaranda tree is blooming out there. Actually, it's quite delightful out there. Do I really want to leave this behind? Okay. No. Oof. Dangerous. So yeah, good friends and whatever. I mean, how can you leave all this behind? But anyway, so this is the world. It's your personal world, what we experience. That is what the world is. And when you think about it, actually, it is a much better way of thinking about the world than we tend to think about it from a modern perspective. A modern perspective is all about the physics and the galaxies out there and the universe and the Big Bang. But we don't have any relationship to those things. They're all abstract. They're all theoretical things we don't really know. But this world right here is the one thing we know for sure. Yeah, you know that you experience right now. Maybe some of you are asleep, so you don't experience very much. But But generally speaking, yeah, we know that we experience right now. This is one thing we know. And all the other things, the universe, the laws of physics, they are abstract things that are derived from this experience that we have now. This is primary. This is the basic thing. Everything else is secondary. So if you really want to talk about the world, it makes much more sense to talk about the personal world. So when the Buddha is talking about seeing the origin of the world, what he means is seeing the origin of personal experience. How does personal experience happen? Yeah? And now if we go back to what this whole thing is about, dependent origination is about rebirth, it's about perpetuating the five khandhas, the five aggregates, yeah, the five factors of personality, then rebirth, that is the that is how the world originates every time, how it re-arises from one life to the next one. Yeah? And the origin of that is craving. Yeah, craving is what gives rise to that world. The personal world arises because of craving. Craving, then the five aggregates come into existence. Yeah? We say that dukkha arises because of the craving, but dukkha is equivalent to the five khandhas, equivalent to the six senses, equivalent to the world, equivalent to so much. Yeah? It's all the same thing, really, seen from different angles. So when you see craving giving rise to rebirth, then you have seen the origin of the world. So when do we see this? When you become a stream enterer, yeah? When you become a sovan. This is the one Sinhala word I know, sovan. I don't know many Sinhala words, that's the one I know. So sovan, a stream enterer. That is when you understand this in the right way. Why is that? Let me try to give you a very brief idea how I understand this. When you become a stream enterer, what you actually see is you see all the five khandhas as dukkha. It's the first time you see dukkha, suffering, you see dukkha fully. That's what it means to become a stream enterer. You have full insight into the nature of reality. Once you see dukkha fully, you cannot have any craving for anything. Yeah, you cannot crave for dukkha, that's impossible. So at that moment, it's the first time in your life you experience what it means to have no craving for anything. Seeing dukkha fully means craving is not compatible with that. Now you understand why craving is ridiculous and stupid. Craving doesn't work. All it does is give you more dukkha in the future. This is the first time in your life that you see craving gone completely. And it's only when something is gone completely that you can understand its nature and its power. Yeah, it's like the famous simile of the tadpole coming out of the water. When the tadpole comes out of the water, then it understands the nature of the water. Once you come out of the water of craving, the moisture of craving, as Anasuna was saying before, yeah, you come out of that moisture of craving, dry land, take all the craving off. Wow, now I understand the power of craving. Why? Because you are secluded from it. You're outside from it. Yeah. So this is one of the main differences between a stream enterer and all ordinary people is that insight into the dukkha of the world, the impermanence of the world, the non-self of the world, and therefore craving stops for the first time in your life. You have completely left craving behind. And then you have an opportunity to understand what it really means and the power it has to drive consciousness in the future from one life to the next one. As long as they're craving, consciousness cannot stop. Life cannot stop. So seeing the origin of the world with right understanding, yeah? So when you see this, what I've just been talking about now, what happens then? You won't have the notion of non-existence regarding the world. If you understand how the world comes into being, how can you have the notion of non-existence? You know that it exists, yeah? You know that it will carry on based on craving. Craving is what drives this. Yeah, craving is what creates the world. This is what the Buddha is saying here. Isn't that interesting? It's such a different viewpoint from kind of almost anyone else. Craving is what creates the world. That is how the world arises. It's kind of fascinating. Yeah, this is so much more interesting in many ways than the kind of Big Bang and all of that, because it doesn't really lead you to any solution. This leads you to real solutions. Craving leads to the origin of world, and because of that, you know that non-existence, which means everything stops when you die, cannot be true. Yeah? You have to give up the annihilationist view. Things do not stop when you die. if you have craving. And most people die with craving, so the world carries on. Are you with me still? Yeah? Okay. Marvelous. Yeah. So then we have the opposite side of things, yeah? When you truly see the cessation of the world with right understanding here. So the cessation of the world is the same insight that you have when you become a stream enterer. You understand the power of craving, and then you understand that if craving stops, the world must stop when you die. Consciousness will not carry on after that because it relies on the moisture of craving for it to perpetuate itself into the future. Yeah, it's the same insight that you have at stream entry here. So the world carries on. The world ceases. Yeah, and for that reason, you know that. Well, what do you know? Well, now you can see what it's pretty obvious what is going on. You won't have the notion of existence in regarding to the world. Yeah, you know that the idea of life carrying on, well, it will carry on, but only if the conditions are right, not if the conditions are missing. Yeah. So you don't have this idea of something being eternal, something being permanent, something being always there, regardless of the conditions. Yeah, so you no longer believe in this permanence inside. So this is what this insight of the Buddha is about. Yeah, this idea of seeing the dependent arising. This is actually what dependent origination is all about. Seeing the dependent arising of things. And then when craving is taken out, seeing the dependent cessation. Whether the world exists or not depends on craving here. If there's craving, the world will carry on. If you take craving out of the equation, the world will stop. So existence is wrong, non-existence is wrong here. Instead, you have dependent origination. That is what the Buddha taught. This is the middle way. And then the Buddha carries on. The world is for the most part shackled by attraction, or I would say shackled by attraction, grasping and insisting. Yeah, so these are just different ways of talking about attachment and holding on to things. Yeah, and this holding on to things in the world, this is what shackles us. Shackles means like you're tied, yeah? You're glued to the world. So glue comes to the mind because I used a lot of glue a few days ago in the monastery. It was gluing, like too much maybe, I don't know, gluing away. So you're glued to the world, you're tied to it because of these attachments and graspings and things. So this is what holds you to the world, yeah? It's very closely related to craving. If you crave, you must grasp, as we shall see later on. But if, when it comes to this attraction, grasping, mental fixation, insisting, an underlying tendency, yeah, all of these holdings on and graspings that we have, it's just a different words, like the suttas often, they give lots of synonyms and things. If you don't get attracted, if you don't grasp, and you don't commit, and this is a critical one, to the notion, myself. Yeah, if you stop grasping, and the most fundamental grasping here is to the notion, myself. If you don't grasp to that, again, this, you have to be a stream mentor not to grasp that, then something very interesting happens. You will have no doubt or uncertainty that what arises is just suffering arising, and what ceases is just suffering ceasing. One of those very famous statements in the suttas that is found here, also found somewhere else, found by the Bhikkhuni Vajira. She says a similar kind of thing in the Bhikkhuni Sanyutta. It's a beautiful little statement, and it's very profound, but it really gives an idea of why consciousness ceasing is not a problem. Yeah, you have now seen that the notion I am, I just mentioned that before, yeah, you don't hold on to the notion I am anymore. And the moment the idea of I am is gone, then you can see the world for what it actually is. As long as you have the idea of I am, you have a vested interest in the five khandhas because you're going to be some of those khandhas. So you think, you can't take away my consciousness, it's mine. Yeah, how can you take away my consciousness? And you have a vested interest in that because you're holding on to it. Yeah, but the moment that is gone, you have no vested interest that allows you to see things as they actually are for the first time. You need to take away that bias, that vested interest in the I am before you can see the world rightly. And that is why giving up the idea of I am, the false notion of I am, is so fundamental to the Buddhist path. When you give that up, suddenly you can see clearly. And you realize that all of these things that you previously took to be yourself, yeah, consciousness as the very base, but also the willed activities, also the perceptions that we have, the feelings we have, the body sometimes, you realize for the first time that actually these things are suffering. You can fully see that because you no longer have a vested interest in them. And what you see, suffering arising and suffering passing away, means that in one life you die, suffering passing away, and then take up another life, suffering arising. Yeah? So you see this empty process. Empty process has got nothing to do with you. Just moving on through time. And once you see non-self, the whole idea is that this whole thing just starts to seem so ridiculous. And you're very happy for your consciousness to cease because you have no interest in that consciousness anymore. You understand the consciousness itself is a problem. The consciousness is the seed for rebirth, and it is a seed for dukkha for that reason. Yeah, you can stand back and you can all you see in the world is suffering arising, suffering passing away. Yeah, that's all you see. If you don't see that, it means you're not the stream enter yet. Sorry. So, nobody has walked out yet. Ooh, okay. Okay, so let's come to the end of this. Your knowledge about this is independent of others. So this means that you are now a stream enterer. You have full insight. Whatever the rest of the world says is irrelevant to you. You know the truth. So if you want to see whether someone is a stream enterer or not, just see how independent they are. If they are the kind of person who is very happy to just go their own way and kind of the world can do what they want, I don't really care, I'm going to go this way because, right, that is one of the characteristics of the stream enterer, complete independence from everyone else. This takes a lot of guts and courage to do that. Yeah, most people, we rely on the relationships that we have in the world. But to go against everyone else, you have the only person that can do that is really the stream mentor. Yeah. This is how right view is defined. All exists. This is one extreme. All exists is similar to the idea of permanence, yeah, the idea that eternalism, yeah, except that you identify the whole of existence with you, yeah, you are part of everything. That's not the only difference. All does not exist is that the whole world has got nothing to do with you. This is the same thing as annihilationism. It's just an alternative way of phrasing these things. Avoiding these two extremes, yeah, these two ends, the realized one teaches the middle way. Actually, it doesn't say the middle way, it just says the middle. I told Aranjadot this translation is wrong, but he didn't listen to me. He wanted to have a way, but it doesn't actually say way, but I guess it's an interpretation here. So usually the middle way is kind of halfway between not indulging and not torturing the body. Here, this is an alternative way of thinking about this middle, teaching by the middle. Yeah, that's why I prefer the middle, because it's not really the middle way, which is the Eightfold Path. What is that middle? Ignorance is a condition for willed activities, and then the other one, the cessation of everything, when ignorance fades away and ceases, with nothing left over, then the choices cease as well. Dependent origination and dependent cessation is that middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. Okay. So, I don't know whether we should... Should we take questions now while we're kind of hot, or should we wait till afterwards? What do you think? I'm too biased to have an opinion. You can make the choice.
Can I challenge you instead of asking a question?
You want to challenge me?
Yes.
Gee, okay, scary. Okay.
Is that okay?
Of course it's okay.
Because you said before that stream winner, they let go
you think they let go of craving for the first time.
Yeah.
But what if you go into a jhana or things like that?
Yeah.
You let go of craving also.
You do. And the difference is that in a jhana, the underlying craving is just temporarily suspended. Yeah. And you don't actually think of craving as having ceased, because the jhana state is all-encompassing and stops you from thinking about that. You never have the insight that all craving is bad or all craving has ceased. As soon as you come out of it again, craving re-arises. Not sensual craving, but craving for existence is there straight away when you come out. So there's never any point at which you reflect and see the situation as being, you know, everything being not worthy of craving. That thing is never there. That only happens with stream entry. It can only happen after you come out of the samadhi state. That's my counter challenge.
Yeah. Because how I understand when the stream winner sees the cessation of the world is when they let go so much that all the six senses they cease for a while. And if you see that they all cease, well, everything stops for a while. That gives you a real new perspective on life. And then you can, maybe you're pointing at that as well. Then you reflect on that and that gives you a new perspective on what was I craving for?
Yeah.
If everything can stop, if there is no essence, then everything is suffering, you know?
Yeah.
Everything is impermanent.
I don't know if that's really the case when you become a streamer that everything ceases, because that has a separate word in the Pali called the Sanyavadayata Niroda, you know, Niroda Samapati in the commentaries. And I would say what you do, you have an insight that the cessation of everything is happy, but you don't actually necessarily experience that ending of everything here. You know that that is the case from then on. You know that that must be the case. But I would argue you don't actually have that experience at that particular point. Anyway, shall we stop that? I think we may lose everyone if we carry on that investigation too much further here. So... Yes. Oh, that is Ajahn Sujato's translation. If you see choices as a translation for sankhara, straight away you know Ajahn Sujato. He's the only one who uses this translation for sankhara. Yeah, that's what it means. Because you know, when you do willed activities, it's like you're choosing something, one way or another. It's always so. It is I think, a nice translation in many ways. And it kind of gives a different perspective on the idea of sankhara, which is kind of useful. He's pretty clever, Ajahn Sujato. Usually, if he tries it in a certain way, there's usually a good reason for it. Yeah, so look for that good reason, and you'll find it. Sometimes he may get it wrong, but most of the time, there's a good reason here. Hey. Okay. So, what does that mean? One question? It's a long question. Is it okay to carry on for 5 minutes to take a few questions? Everyone okay with that? Yeah? Okay, let's do that then. Just because we are kind of on the topic now.
Quite a number of things, because they're all connected. It's very hard to make it a short question because they're all connected. But the inspiration is from Ajahn Sujato's alternative to that definition of sankhara,
yeah.
And I find that the translations aren't good.
Yeah.
To use volitional formations as sankhara is really bad. I guess my thinking is that it's always good to have a challenging alternative viewpoint. I suppose is that. Yes, death is the cause of suffering, it's dukkha, but the being does not stop existing at death. The being only ceases to exist in nirvana. In every other circumstance, the being exists, at least as an unborn or as a gandhava. So I think the word sankhara would be better translated as not just habit, but habit's a good word. Habit, it implies choice, implies volition, And it, but the thing about habit, the difference about habit is that it's something that you repeatedly do. And you need that repetition for that to be a sankhara for the rest of the steps of dependent origination. So after sankhara, you have consciousness, which I know you made the point that consciousness, when the word consciousness is used here, it's not the six types of consciousness that we normally talk about. But I think consciousness here simply means the most basic sense of self. Because you can't do something intentionally without having a sense of self. Volition implies at least a very basic sense of self. So I think a better choice for the translation of consciousness is simply a sense of self, the basic sense of self. And after that, what's the next one? After that is nama rupa. Nama rupa expands on that. That is your identity. Right. From the very basic sense of self, you have an identity, which then becomes the sixfold contact basis, I think is the next factor, which is normally believed to be the actual physical form. But I think if you have the concept of Gandhava or the unborn, I think the unborn person, or for that matter, every night when I'm sleeping, I still have a sense of self in my dream. I'm still active through the six senses, although they're not real. They're all mind-made.
Yeah.
And so in that way, they're similar to a Gandhava. So for that reason, name and form is like self-identity. And you mentioned some beings have fine bodies.
Yeah.
That's another word for the sixfold contact base. So it's like a body, not necessarily a physical body.
Yeah.
And someone asked earlier on also about is dependent origination a teaching based directed towards human beings or all beings? I think that's a very interesting question that should be delved in further.
Yeah.
That's all. Yeah.
Yeah. Long question, probably has a long answer. Yeah. So, first of all, with habits, I think there is something to be said for habits, absolutely, because that is part of the problem, that we cannot do things habitually and we choose habitually. Yeah. But it is not just that. Yeah? I mean, you can also change your habits. It's possible. And this is kind of very much what the path is about. Yeah? And you're actually choosing away from your habits and choosing in a different direction. Yeah? So your willed actions are changing. The goalposts are changing here. Yeah? So I think maybe if you say, you have a point. I can see where you're coming from. But I think for someone who practices the spiritual path, it is not quite sufficient, because it's that whole idea of changing your willed actions that's actually an important part of it. When it comes to the consciousness being the I am consciousness, it is obviously the I am consciousness is an important part of how we experience the world. That is not how it is defined in dependent origination. It's actually defined as the six sense consciousnesses. Yeah? So when you get reborn, all those consciousnesses, they kind of arise together, because the mind is there and the nama rupa is there. So all those six sense consciousnesses are now fixed in that particular realm, and you will experience all of them within that realm. That is actually how it is defined. If it meant the I am consciousness, then the moment you become an arahant, everything would cease. Yeah, and all that there would be nothing left if that is all it meant. There would be no consciousness anymore. Yeah? But as an arahant, you are still conscious to the end of your life. Yeah, even though the I am is gone, the I am consciousness is gone, you're still conscious. And that must mean, in part, that the consciousness here means something more than just the I am consciousness. Lastly, about nama rupa being an extension of your personality factors. Again, I agree with that one. I have no real problem with that one at all. We absolutely agree with. We attach to these things and we hold on to them, and we make this who we are as people. So anyway, that's how I would respond, Jake. So yeah.
And the last point you made about a dependent origination, the way it's taught by the Buddha, does it apply mainly to human beings, or also to other human beings, to what extent? I agree that from a theoretical perspective, I think it's worth looking at that.
But from a practical perspective, in a sense, it doesn't matter. It's sort of a moot point because we are all human beings. And so these teachings apply to us right now in this life. And this is the life that we've got to work on it. So it becomes sometimes a bit theoretical. Does it apply also to other beings? Well, yeah, in a sense. But in a sense, it doesn't really matter to us now, right? Because we're human beings. I assume you're all human beings. Right? Not some hiding nagas in there or something.
That's a good story about that, though.
Yeah.
Well, won't tell it now. It's just too short. Let us quickly take these last questions from outside while we're at it. The question from Sydney, is the unconditioned, the asankata, or the nibbana element, is it independent of conditions? From Gio. Nothing is independent of conditions. Yeah, asankata just means that it is you cannot fall back. Yeah, it is independent of certain conditions. They are independent of the conditions of the defilements, independent of the craving, independent of that sort of thing. But nothing is completely independent. It's impossible. Yeah, if you are an arahant, yeah, and you have kind of that is called the asankata, yeah, the nibbana dhatu, an arahant. Still, there are conditions. Yeah, you get food one day, that kind of food, and then you kind of go to the toilet, you know, and all of these things are conditioned things, and you live within the conditioned realm. So asankata just means a limited set of conditions that you are free from, but like everyone, you are still dependent on general conditions of life.
I don't like the translation unconditioned for asankata. Asankata means more like the end of creating new things. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that. The freedom from creation or whatever. Exactly. Yeah.
Because nibbana is, in a sense, is still conditioned by the Eightfold Path.
Mm.
So if you say nibbana is unconditioned, it sounds like, yeah, there's no way to get there almost. So I don't like that translation.
Yeah.
So,
Good. Yeah. Okay. A couple more questions very quickly. How can I practice well when I have intense fears and anxieties when reflecting or practicing metta or anything, the Eightfold Path or even right view? Any suggestions? Okay. So if you have fear in your meditation practice, don't meditate. Yeah. Come back to the more basic factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Come back to right speech, right action, even right way of thinking. And as you practice those more basic things, gradually your mind will start to become more amenable to meditation practice as well. These things usually come together. And then, you know, if you enjoy the Buddhist suttas or the Buddhist way of thinking about the world, and maybe read some suttas, get more understanding so that your right view starts to arise. And these are the things you can do. But don't force yourself to meditate if it is difficult. It is quite common. It is not that uncommon for people to have bad experience in meditation. Yeah. And the reason is they're not ready for that part of the path yet. And that's okay. Yeah, there's nothing to be ashamed about. Anything. It's just the nature of human beings. Not everyone is ready. And if you feel bad, please don't do it, because you're going to just become averse to meditation practice. Go back to the more simpler things. Practice those, and one day you will be ready for meditation practice as well. Yeah. Last one is from Gabriel Ahimsa. Can you talk a bit about trying causing less possible suffering to sentient beings? I find ahimsa an amazing concept. Yeah, you've obviously taken the name, so you must find it a really nice concept, so that's good. So this is a very fundamental part of the Buddhist path, the idea of having compassion for others, being kind, not causing suffering to others, causing happiness for others, in fact. Yeah, saying kind words, doing the right thing, thinking the right thoughts towards others, is such an important, fundamental part of the path. So if you can practice ahimsa all the way, you know, to its maximum expression within your mind or whatever, through metta, through your actions or whatever, your meditation is going to be really, really powerful if you can do that. So it's absolutely, you're right, you can go a long, long way on the path just by practicing ahimsa, metta, compassion, all of these beautiful qualities. Okay, let's take a break here. And there will be meditation at 3, and then